Tell me what Quantum is going to do to Bitcoin.
So there is an algorithm called Shor's algorithm, which allows someone with a powerful enough quantum computer to essentially be able to reverse engineer private key from a public key. On the Bitcoin blockchain, sometimes when you just deposit funds, it depends upon the actual script type that you're using to lock your money, but always when you are spending funds, you are revealing that public key. So the short version of the problem here is that at the moment there's around 5 million Bitcoin that have their public keys exposed on the blockchain, which anybody can download, anybody can find. And so if someone has a computer that's powerful enough, they can start looking at those keys, they can see how much money is in them, and they could start running Shor's algorithm on their quantum computer to get the private key, which would then allow them to spend the money.
Welcome back to another episode of the Financial Fox Show. My name is Steffi, and here every week we explore how Bitcoin, digital assets, and emerging technology are shaping the future finance, but also our lives, right, and our society and economy. So I think the last few months really focusing on digital asset treasuries. We have said a lot about Bitcoin and we are going to keep doing it. But today I wanted to bring a different topic that I'm personally very interested in, and I think everybody that is in this space should really pay attention to, and that's quantum computing. So quantum computers use the principle of quantum mechanics to process information in ways that today's computers simply can't. Obviously, we know that companies like Google, IBM are making massive progress, but people still think that we are in very early stages, but maybe we are not, you know, far off as we think. So the important things to remember is that quantum computing has actually the potential to disrupt everything. And when it comes down to Bitcoin and crypto, it raises serious questions around encryption security and the future of decentralized network. So maybe we should pay more attention and maybe we should do something about it. In this episode, I will be joined by Jameson Loop, Bitcoin security advocate and co-founder of the self-custody platform Casa. So Jameson was one of the co-authors of a new draft Bitcoin improvement proposal aimed at protecting the network against future quantum threats. When I saw the proposal in July, I said, definitely I want to get Jameson on the show because I think it will be very important, you know, first of all, you know, for myself to kind of hear directly from him, but also for you all. And that's, you know, the main things while I'm doing the show is to share some very important insights that anybody in crypto should pay attention to. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I really hope that you do as well. And also start thinking about important aspect of this industry and where we are heading and the challenge that might come in the way as there is more adoption of Bitcoin and digital assets. Because with more adoption, there are always more challenges. And a technology challenge like quantum could be, yeah, quite a big one. So let's dive into it. Before we do that, just I want to say a couple of things. First of all, big thank you to our partner, Hive Digital Technologies, one of the fastest growing publicly listed Bitcoin miners and good friends of us, and also supporter of our show. They are becoming the most efficient Bitcoin miner in the industry. And they were also the first crypto miner to implement an AI strategy. That's very important to remember because nowadays the Bitcoin mining industry is becoming really an energy powerhouse, attracting lots of attention from big technology companies looking and developing AI solutions. Now, Hive has data centers in Canada, Sweden, and Paraguay, Uruguay that now has become the big focus, and those data centers are all powered entirely by green energy. So that's a very important aspect, is the sustainability of the business, and also the priority that is really to build and scale a lean shareholder-focused company that also transforms the community where they operate. So if you want to know more about Hive, I suggest to visit hivedigitaltechnologies.com to learn more, and also Buzz HPC, which is the AI subsidiary that now is making big moves in Canada, looking at sovereign AI. So definitely something that you want to check out. Now, before we jump into my conversation with Jameson, a couple of other things. Remember that the content on the show is for informational purposes only and not intended as financial advice. So any opinions expressed by me or my guests are ours alone, and you should not act solely on the back of them. As always, do your own research, level up your skills, and be accountable for your own decisions. So that's maybe an unusual disclaimer, but it's very, very important, because those conversations can empower you, but we will never tell you what to do. You are the one that is making your own decisions, and you should always feel that kind of responsibility. It's very important for anything that you do in life. Now, the last things I'm gonna ask you that is so important for us, please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel if you are watching this interview on YouTube, or if it's X, please just give a like, a share, and also follow us on X. Your support is so crucial for us to grow the channel and educate more people about crypto. Now, let's get into my conversation with Jameson. Hi, Jameson. How are you?
Not bad. Security business always keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Oh, well, let's start with that. Tell us, who are you?
Well, I'm a computer scientist by trade. I've been building software as a service for nearly 20 years now. And I've been building on top of Bitcoin for over a decade. Specifically, I've focused on self-custody multi-sig products. So just trying to help people be better at being their own banks. And back in 2018, I co-founded Casa, and we've really been providing a platform, software, and advisory services that are really targeted to high net worth individuals, really anyone who has a lot of Bitcoin. I would say, like, if you're a whole coiner, then it makes sense to give us a call and look into our offerings. And we just try to protect people from all the bad stuff that's out there, and also protect them from themselves. Because once you get into self-custody, the chances that you screw something up go up quite a bit.
Yeah, interesting. Because obviously self-custody has become a kind of hot topic as more people adopt Bitcoin. And one of the things that I always kind of ask myself and other people, are we really ready to self-custody our assets? I mean, some are, but not everybody is. And, you know, and obviously self-custody is an important piece of the future of finance and, you know, ownership. But I feel kind of us as human, you know, human beings, and maybe how society and the economy has been developed for, you know, the last 100 of years. Maybe we are not ready for that. Or, I mean, I really would love to know from your perspective, because, you know, you are working with clients, corporations. Do you think, are we ready?
At a societal level, no, because it is such a massive paradigm shift. Yeah. Really, like, what you're referring to is the way that human civilization has evolved and progressed over millennia is through specialization of tasks. And when you're taking advantage of specialization, what you're really doing is you're outsourcing major aspects of your life to trusted third parties under the assumption that they're going to be more effective at accomplishing that task. And that's great. We don't have to be subsistence farmers anymore, right? We don't have to spend a large part of our lives worrying about where the food is going to come from, because somebody else takes care of that. And we just go to the market and pick up what we want. But that becomes problematic when you have, you know, really important aspects of your life, like your wealth, that are now being outsourced to trusted third parties that can, they can screw you over. They can be infiltrated. They can be pressured by governments. You know, there's many different things that can go wrong that then result in you getting locked out of your own money. So obviously self-custody, from our perspective, is one of the greatest offerings that Bitcoin really made to the world. And it's very empowering to be your own bank. The part that people aren't ready for is the responsibility that comes along with that. And there's so many traps out there because it's deceptively simple to go install a software wallet or to buy a single hardware device and move all your money onto it and then just completely overlook many different security aspects and things that could go wrong that you should prepare for. And if you aren't prepared for them and that thing goes wrong, you know, there's no way of getting your money back. So that's really the main thing that we're providing at Casa is we are making it easy for someone to get into a self-custody architecture that is already by default set up in such a way that you can be human, you can make mistakes, you can even have failures happen, whether it's like natural disaster or even an external attacker. And if a failure happens, there's redundancy built into the system so that it's not a catastrophic loss.
So you can actually recoup your digital assets if you are with Casa, if you lose the keys.
Yeah, that's the idea, is that because you have multiple keys, if something goes wrong with one of the keys, or if you're in a higher number of key setup, potentially even multiple keys can be lost or compromised or destroyed, and you still have enough key material that is distributed around that you can then recover from it and basically recreate your vault with a new set of keys.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's just so interesting because this is exactly the point of banks, right, that you have described. That's why banks exist, to hold your money. Well, they don't actually hold your money, not funny enough. But yeah, it makes us think, really, are we ready for, you know, a new paradigm where actually we are going to be responsible for our own assets, and also make you think, what's the future of banking, really? Because I think banking obviously is going through that kind of journey itself. I'm going to ask you a question that just came up because we have been doing a series on Bitcoin treasury companies, and obviously the first things that, you know, having somebody that can provide services like that, and maybe, you know, seeing what you have seen over the last year, if I'm a publicly listed company and I'm building a Bitcoin treasury strategy, probably makes sense to also look at different ways to store the Bitcoin that is not on an exchange or is in a custody.
I would say eliminate single point of failure is really what you're looking for.
Especially when you are dealing with shareholder money, because that's not just your own company, right? You are adding different type of responsibility that is not just you. It's actually your shareholder. And I know that many CEO maybe, you know, they think more about how we get the share price up, but really the most important thing is building value for shareholders. So tell me about what have you seen in the last year from that angle? Did you get requests? Are you actually services any Bitcoin treasury company? I don't want to obviously know details that you can't disclose, but it will be interesting to understand if self-custody solutions are something that public listed company are looking, and then your view, should they do that?
Yeah, so it's interesting from a regulatory perspective. The traditional custodians who are actually storing money on behalf of their clients directly are often required to use a qualified custodian in order to store those assets. But that's only for the custodians where they have a client who comes to them and says, either gives them Bitcoin directly or says, you know, here's my fiat, now buy the Bitcoin and that's going to be my Bitcoin. But treasury companies are not in that category. While you know, ostensibly the funds in the treasury are kind of owned by shareholders, because shareholders, you know, equity holders have ownership in the company and all of the assets of the company, it doesn't fall under that specific financial regulation where you have to use a qualified custodian. So you have some optionality. Now, as far as I'm aware, currently all of the publicly listed companies that are touted as Bitcoin treasury companies are using some trusted third-party custodian to actually handle the funds. But at Casa, we do have a number of Bitcoin treasury clients, though these are generally privately held companies or smaller companies. And so I think that, you know, really any company that has a Bitcoin treasury, regardless of whether or not you're marketing yourself as a Bitcoin treasury company, that it does make sense to set it up in such a way that the, you know, the executives or other key personnel at the company have a shared ownership and control over the funds so that you aren't having to outsource to a trusted third party. But of course, you can do it either way. There's pros and cons to each, but I think anyone who has read the Bitcoin white paper should understand that, like, the fundamental value premise that Satoshi said, you know, the reason that Bitcoin was created was due to all of the problems inherent to trusted third parties. So it seems pretty silly to just throw that fundamental value right out the window.
It's very interesting because this is so important. The ownership, the ability to be your own banker, but then people like to have somebody to blame, isn't it? So that's why they maybe want the third party. Oh, it's the custodian that got hacked, or, you know, that was not really my fault, you know. But definitely would be interesting to maybe look at how a Bitcoin treasury company could, you know, could set that up. Maybe we can have another conversation about it. Now, I really wanted to do this interview to talk about quantum. But obviously security is, you know, at the base of this conversation anyway. So it's good for you, you know, it's good for you to kind of give us some background and tell us about what have you seen. The last question that I wanted to ask you before we go into the quantum, how this cycle has played for Casa? I mean, give me some insight on, you know, the company's activity. Were you more busy? Are you more busy in the bear market? What kind of challenge do you get when Bitcoin price is going up? Just give me some, give me some insights.
I think the simplest way to describe sort of the busyness of the company is that it's effectively a derivative of the exchange rate. So if the exchange rate is going up, then we get really, really busy. That's generally because, you know, people are getting wealthier, they're looking at their holdings, and they're realizing the value has gone up a lot, and perhaps I should improve the level of security that I have for these holdings. On the other hand, you know, if the price is going down or if the price is just flat, that's when things get pretty quiet. So, you know, for the past few months, it's been a pretty quiet summer. You know, we've been just sort of going up and down a little bit, but generally staying flat. And, you know, right now, everybody's wondering, is this cycle different? You know, everybody's sort of pulling up the previous cycle charts and overlaying them on top of each other and saying, well, is it the four-year cycle and we only have a few months left? Or is all of the new institutional capital that's starting to flow in going to lengthen the cycle? Obviously, I think we're all hoping for the latter, that, you know, we have a bit longer and that the floodgates haven't fully opened yet.
What do you think about it? Because you have been in crypto for long enough to kind of analyze this cycle, see there is definitely a pattern, but obviously this cycle is different than the others. Where do you think we are right now?
I mean, we've been in a bull market for like a year and a half now. It's definitely different. So on one hand, I track a lot of different metrics around just activity, interest, sentiment, so on and so forth. And one thing that's different about this cycle is that there's no real retail participation. Like we haven't really seen the sort of FOMO and hype and massive amounts of regular people getting into the crypto space like they did in 2021.
Wait a second on that. What about the meme coin mania? What about, Ordinals was specifically on Bitcoin, but it was kind of like a new wave of artists just getting involved and creating stuff on chain. So was that not the retail involvement, or you thought that maybe kind of let's slow down now and...
Yeah, that was a little bump. It wasn't like insane levels. You know, I think that was still, it was kind of an echo of crypto degens that had still hung around since the last cycle.
It's the NFT.
Yeah, you know, people who there's still plenty of people hanging around who are like, "When alt season? When alt season?" And I've been telling everybody, "No, it's actually suit coin season, right? It's the year of institutional capital and treasury companies and so on and so forth." And so that makes it even harder to predict. For me, that's I think the big question with regard to the cycles repeating is that the cycles have always been retail driven before. So it started to become really obvious when you're getting retail mania and your cab driver was telling you about crypto and so on and so forth. And I think that's the open question is, does a sort of blow off top for a cycle have to be retail driven, or are we going to see a blow off top that is institution driven? I don't know.
That's that kind of raise me. Want to raise another question? We are not going to get into the question for a bit. Let's go back to the DATs, the digital asset treasury companies, and exactly what you're saying. There's going to be, maybe there's going to be an institutional blow up, right? Could that be in the digital asset treasury field? And if that is the case, bearing in mind maybe what are your views, or you know, sharing with us your views on where we are with this industry. What are the red flags or the things that make you know, maybe worry you a little bit more when it comes down to, you know, public listed company building a Bitcoin treasury strategy that, I mean, it's good that there is a treasury. But then what's the strategy? It's just accumulating forever.
Yeah, that's the question. I would think that the risk when it comes to treasury companies is mostly going to come down to leverage. And so this is where different treasury companies are going to have different risk profiles. So I would be less worried about a like 2017 style blow up and more worried about a 2021, 2022 blow up, which is more leverage based. The question is, do we get to a point where the sort of market of treasury companies becomes so large, so saturated, so competitive that some of the companies, probably the smaller ones, start taking on more risk and more leverage in order to jockey for position, to make their equity look more tantalizing to the market? And if they end up, you know, taking on too much risk, and they perhaps have a bunch of loans or other relationships set up where they have actually lost or given up, you know, control of some of that Bitcoin in order to try to earn money on it. If those contractual relationships start blowing up due to whatever the lendees are doing, you know, that could be potential for a cascading collapse of at least some of those companies essentially going bankrupt because they bit off more than they can chew. And I think a lot of people are expecting at least some of the smaller companies to fail. Now, obviously, MicroStrategy is the gold standard, and everybody looks at these different equities that they're issuing and what the terms are and how much optionality Strategy as a company has over kind of pulling the different levers there and manipulating them. And I think that Strategy has been quite conservative. You know, when they've taken on leverage and, you know, taken out loans and stuff, they tend to only do it on really, really long term, you know, like 4 year and longer terms. So, you know, it makes them a lot less exposed to the short and medium term volatility.
Yeah, obviously we don't know where what can happen in the next 5 years. I mean, Bitcoin is definitely, for now, I think there is general consensus that is on a trajectory that is going to go up, but you know, you never know what's happening. And that's why I want to come back to quantum, because you know, I shared with you before that, you know, I talk with different people in capital markets, and obviously you say, you know, what about if there is a challenge to Bitcoin where the price, for some kind of reason goes down substantially? And one of the things that I brought up is, what about quantum? And the answer that you get is mainly, oh, no, you know what you're saying, we are kind of like 10 years away, it's nothing gonna happen. I know a bit about it, but not enough to kind of build an argument around it. And definitely you are somebody that knows more about the subject, as you know, you have been proactively putting together a draft with some other guys about how Bitcoin can actually, the Bitcoin community can take action to make the network more resilient. So first of all, Tell me where we are with Quantum, and are we 10 years away, or, you know, is that something that people should worry about?
Yeah, it's tricky because I am not a quantum computing expert or a cryptographer, but I've been talking about this and investigating, researching, talking to quantum and cryptographic experts about it for about a year now. And I think, yeah, we probably have 10 years, maybe longer. I think it's highly unlikely that a cryptographically relevant quantum computer appears in the next 5 years. But even if it is 10 years away, I think that means we need to start planning for it now. And really, the primary problem is that it's very, very difficult to change Bitcoin. And this would be unprecedented in the sense that we've never had an upgrade to Bitcoin before that required people to move their funds. And that is going to take a really long time because you can't force anybody to do anything in Bitcoin. So, you know, first of all, it takes generally several years, and that this time frame is getting longer and longer due to ossification and network effects, but it generally takes several years to get a Bitcoin proposal adopted and activated. And that's just at the protocol, at the network level. Even once that happens, it usually takes several more years for those changes to matriculate out throughout the entire ecosystem, for all of the wallets and the custodians to update their software to take advantage of the changes. And then the thing that would be different in this case is that there is a third stage where you need to actually get everybody to move their money from a quantum vulnerable locking script into a quantum safe locking script. So I expect that would take several more years. So you can see already, like, it looks like it would probably take 7+ years to actually get all the way through that process. And that's why I'm saying we should start planning for it right now. I think the best case scenario is that we can continue monitoring progress on the quantum computing front of progress, both on the software efficiency level and the hardware computational power level. And we hope that that continues to progress in a somewhat predictable linear pattern so that we can see we have many years ahead of us, but we can see that we're getting to the point where it should be concerned. The sort of black swan event would be if there's some massive breakthrough that increases computational power by orders of magnitude. So right now we are several orders of magnitude away from anyone having a quantum computer that's powerful enough to actually crack the elliptic curve algorithm that Bitcoin uses. So there will have to be multiple major breakthroughs, but we are seeing massive breakthroughs happening. So, you know, there have been like order of magnitude improvements, for example, in error correction handling, which is one of the several variables that quantum computers have to overcome in order to actually get more powerful. But you know, it's something that we all just have to remain vigilant of. And I think that having multiple plans in place for multiple different scenarios of quantum computing approaching slowly versus quantum computing approaching very quickly and surprising us, we can have plans in place for a number of these eventualities.
Tell me, what's the vulnerability? I mean, what quantum is going to do to Bitcoin?
So there is an algorithm called Shor's algorithm, which allows someone with a powerful enough quantum computer to essentially be able to reverse engineer a private key from a public key. And on the Bitcoin blockchain, sometimes when you just deposit funds, it depends upon the actual script type that you're using to lock your money. But always when you are spending funds, you are revealing that public key. So the short version of the problem here is that at the moment, there's around 5 million Bitcoin that have their public keys exposed on the blockchain, which anybody can download, anybody can find. And so if someone has a computer that's powerful enough, they can start looking at those keys, they can see how much money is in them, and they could start running Shor's algorithm on their quantum computer to get the private key, which would then allow them to spend the money.
So tell me, who has these publicly available keys?
I mean, it's anyone who has been using Bitcoin, especially anyone who is reusing their Bitcoin address, has exposed their public keys. It's also anyone who was using Bitcoin back in the first 2 or 3 years, where they were actually the only address type that existed back then was this raw public key address type. And so anyone who put funds or was mining back then and never moved the funds to a newer address type, all of that Bitcoin. So, you know, some people say, well, we think that Satoshi likely has 1 million coins. And so all of that, for example, is exposed.
It's exposed. Okay, interesting. Okay, so that makes sense. I mean, it just makes me think right now that we get nation states, they are building pile of, you know, strategic stockpile, and that there might be a reason why another country should try to do something with quantum computing to kill another nation if that nation has built up a substantial
maybe. Yeah. So, like, we really learned, I went to a quantum Bitcoin summit a few months ago in San Francisco, and we were told by several people who are building quantum computing companies that it's really an arms race between China and the United States. And so, you know, China has historically been very fickle about Bitcoin. You know, they've banned Bitcoin many different times in many different ways over the years. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if someone higher level in the Chinese government decided, hey, we've got access to this quantum computer now. Let's destroy Bitcoin for real.
So, okay, let's look at that scenario. What's going to happen?
It really depends on a number of different variables. If a quantum computer is built and we have no protection whatsoever in the Bitcoin protocol, that's a really bad situation, because the only place that you can really run to safety is moving your Bitcoin to an address that you've never used before and that is not revealing the public key. So yeah. Taproot addresses, for example, are not safe. They automatically reveal the public key. But even then, it's not a perfect security solution, because when you eventually go to spend that Bitcoin, you do have to reveal the public key, and you could be exposed to something called a short-range attack, which is basically if someone has a quantum computer that's fast enough that it can reverse engineer the private key in the amount of time that it takes for the next block to get confirmed, they can swipe the money right out of the mempool and basically redirect it to themselves.
So basically, either you just don't move them.
Yeah, but Bitcoin becomes a lot less useful if you can't even spend it securely.
Yeah, you can't even touch it. So that's, do you see this happening, I mean, in your scenario that you have considered, as like a bomb, right? Boom. One go, or there will be different attempts that maybe raise awareness and people panic, and, you know, it's going to be all happening in one go or not?
So there's many variables, right? Partially it depends on is it a good actor or a bad actor who achieves quantum supremacy, and what will their thought process be around how they're going to do it. If it's a really, really good actor, it's actually possible for them to prove to us that they have a quantum computer, you know, without stealing any money. And you know, that could, you know, essentially kick us all into gear into actually adopting a solution much faster. But if it's a bad actor, or just really, I would say, a self-interested actor, then I think what you start doing, if you're trying to get away with it for a really long time, you would start cracking a lot of the smaller addresses that are likely lost, that nobody is going to be complaining about if the money moves. And, you know, we would see these movements happen, but we wouldn't know for sure what was happening if you were just taking a little bit here and there. But if you really wanted to hurt Bitcoin, there are addresses out there with over 100,000 Bitcoin in them, like Binance, Bitfinex, a number of different exchanges and large custodians have almost all of their money in one address that has the public keys exposed. So if you swiped those, that would, you know, create massive market panic. And obviously, if you tried to liquidate hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin, that would crash the market pretty substantially.
It's like a bank run, basically. Everybody wants to get out, the price.
Yeah, and then, like, once people are fairly confident that there is a quantum computer that is attacking coins, then really the only logical thing to do is to sell all of your Bitcoin. So that would create, I think, a cascading a market effect.
I mean, we have seen that a lot because I remember so well in the previous cycle when I think it was Blockify or, you know, and the Celsius and Blockify, they kind of started to have problems and people were just moving assets quickly and, you know, selling and that kind of showing the price when there is, you know, panic. Then you see the assets going down quite a lot. And obviously, if you are not sometimes like, if you are just a retail player, you get damaged even more than, you know, the one that have got access to the better trades and stuff like that. Well, that doesn't sound really good. So what was your proposal? What did you propose with the guys? I think it came out in July, wasn't it?
Yeah, so my proposal is not about the initial quantum safe signature scheme, because I'm not a cryptographer. I'm not really going to weigh in on that. There's a number of different algorithms out there. They all have trade-offs. They're all terrible for Bitcoin and different reasons, because they tend to have huge data footprints. My improvement proposal is actually focusing on the actual migration, the sort of game theory and incentives of, under the assumption that we have a best case scenario where quantum computing is slowly improving and we can see it coming and we want to adopt a new signature scheme, we get consensus for that, then how do we actually get everybody to migrate their funds over, and how do we protect everyone once that's done? And so essentially, it's like a three-phase scheme that I've proposed where you activate whatever the new quantum safe cryptography is, and when you do that, you then stop accepting transactions that are sending money to any of the old address schemes that are quantum vulnerable. And the idea there is that this is how you notify people that something has happened, because there's no way to, you know, email or contact every Bitcoin user. It's just not a thing. Obviously, we can spread the word on social media and companies will contact everyone that they know of, but there's no reliable way to contact every Bitcoin user. But I think if people see that their Bitcoin transactions are not confirming, that will really spur them to look into the cause of why that's happening. So with that next phase, then hopefully that will get more people to actually upgrade their wallets, move their money into quantum safe addresses. And then the next phase, we're talking like several years for each phase because it's a very slowly moving ecosystem. And then the next phase, several years later, is to just completely reject any spends from quantum vulnerable UTXOs, which is basically saying, okay, you know, we've given people many years to migrate, and now in order to actually stop any future quantum attackers, we're not going to allow for funds to be spent from vulnerable addresses because we no longer have any assurance that they're being spent by the actual legitimate owner. It could just be some attacker with a quantum computer. And, you know, this of course is quite controversial because if someone's not paying attention, they're not going to be able to spend their money. It is effectively burning a fair amount of coins. Like all of those lost coins, we would expect would just get permanently locked. And in order to try to alleviate some of those objections, this is where more research is required, but it should be possible to then create a quantum safe recovery scheme for people who have funds in those locked scripts. But that's going to be more complicated, and it's going to require coming up with a new proof system, you know, perhaps some sort of zero knowledge proof system where, in addition to providing the cryptographic signature that corresponds to the public key that is protecting those coins, you would have to provide additional information such as your extended public key and your derivation path that your wallet used. That is essentially showing that you don't only have the private key, because a quantum attacker would have the private key, but a quantum attacker would not have this additional wallet information to show that they can deterministically derive these keys from some master key.
So I'm just going to ask you a question you might think is a dumb question, but if we don't have a quantum computing that can break Bitcoin right now, how can we put in place a framework that will protect us from something that is not here yet?
Well, I mean, we can implement whatever rules people agree to. I think that this is really the question, though, is like, you don't want to implement something preemptively, like too early. If it turns out that quantum computing hits some sort of unknown limit of physics that makes it so that we then find out later that, oh, okay, it's actually, as far as we know, it's physically impossible to create a quantum computer that is powerful enough to crack this cryptography. Yeah. Then you could argue, could have caused some harm to Bitcoin by making it too complicated and, you know, making these transaction sizes larger than they actually needed to be. So I think that's going to be one of the massive aspects of the debate is like, when do we actually do it? Like, when does it look like it is really going to be a problem and that it the cost-benefit analysis causes us to agree that we need to actually take action to do something? But you don't want to be too late, because that's when you're going to have the massive market liquidations.
It's interesting that, because it kind of like in my head, I immediately think about personal data. I immediately think about Bitcoin is all about, you know, ownership, personal ownership. So what about linking the owner data as another within the security and the keys? So it becomes really pretty much like my Bitcoin is me, if that kind of makes sense. And so a quantum computing can get some of my data, but not really all of them, unless that is powered by AI, and then, you know, maybe could. But I think as a human beings, we still retain certain level of data set that, you know, are not publicly available.
Well, I think that if anyone was proposing to like tie other sorts of identifying information to your Bitcoin, I think that would get rejected pretty much outright.
Because
one of the primary things of Bitcoin is you should be able to operate pseudonymously. Like you should need is to have that cryptographic data to be able to prove ownership.
It's a difficult thing, right? And I understand that it's not something straightforward. Why you decided to work on this proposal?
Because I think it's one of several like really long-term concerns that I have. And this is actually a natural evolution of like before I was talking about quantum stuff, I had spent the past year or two talking about ossification. And ossification is basically, it's basically its own kind of law of network physics, in the sense that as a network grows, as the number of participants within a peer-to-peer or a network protocol grows larger and larger, it naturally becomes more and more difficult to coordinate any changes across all of those entities, because you're essentially, a protocol is a type of language, it's a computer language. And the value of the network requires that everyone be speaking the same language. But if you grow to the point where you have, you know, millions and millions of people, there's no way of coordinating amongst all of them to say, hey, we all need to update to this new version of the language. It just becomes too difficult. And like, we've already seen that play out with a number of internet-based protocols that are sort of lower in the stack. I like to talk about the email protocol a lot because I worked on email software for a decade, a long time ago. And it's because of that and the fact that Bitcoin is getting slower and slower to be able to evolve that I think that, you know, we want to get as many improvements in as quickly as we can before we reach the point of no return. And no one will know when that is. We might already be beyond the point of no return when no other changes will ever happen to the Bitcoin protocol, but I think we have to keep trying.
Should be the custody providers be the ones they start to build something quantum resistant, quantum resistant self-custody wallets? I mean, I'm just a self-custody solution, and then, you know, give the option to individuals, to corporations, whoever is holding Bitcoin to bring their assets onto that. I mean, because you at Casa, you could do that, I guess.
Kind of. There are best practices that we can implement in the wallet software to try to prevent people from reusing addresses and having long-term exposed public keys. But fundamentally, you need an improvement to happen at the protocol layer. Otherwise, you're going to end up, even if you're protecting against long range attacks, you're eventually going to be susceptible to those short range attacks when people are spending their coins.
So what do you mean by that? What needs to happen at the base layer?
We need to implement an algorithm that is quantum safe, that is not elliptic curve digital signature algorithm that we're using right now.
That means a lot of work. Who is going to do it?
Well, this is where the Bitcoin improvement proposal and the consensus, you could call it governance process of Bitcoin, comes into play. You have people who are technical and who care about a given issue, and they work on coming up with the draft proposal and get it peer reviewed by as many other interested technical people in the space, and you just keep talking about it, keep iterating, and try to keep driving it forward to the point where we can get a rough consensus that this is what needs to be done. But it's a difficult process.
I really think that, you know, talking more about it is definitely one thing. It will be interesting to get the quantum people, you know, on the side, maybe the one that you're working on these technologies. I know the UK is quite advanced on the quantum computing technologies, and having my friend at a quantum VC fund. So maybe also see their perspective. They're not really crypto people. That's the problem. It's not easy maybe for them to kind of like dive deep more into what is the impact of Bitcoin specifically. But I guess that, you know, it won't be so difficult to kind of bring the two things together. But I definitely think talking more about it, getting more people aware, maybe getting the key player on board, get Michael Saylor to kind of pay attention, I think that's definitely important. Well, it's a very pressing topic from my perspective, because I think if we are not 10 years away, and like we said, maybe from a geopolitical level, something is going to happen. Obviously, the US doesn't have yet a stockpile that is, you know, relevant enough for China to, you know, consider about an attack. But, you know, as they are moving quite fast, so maybe it is in 5 years and we don't know what has been happening in China or somewhere else. You know, we are always blaming China, but it might be another country that we never expected. But anyway, yeah, that's definitely something important to consider. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing that with us. If there is anything that we can help to raise awareness, and yeah, more than happy to support.
Yeah, it's a weird issue, because it's simultaneously not an issue but also a potential existential crisis. So like the issue in and of itself is kind of a quantum state. It's very difficult to tell, but I don't think it can hurt by trying to be prepared for it.
No, but also understand, you know, like the best practice, like you said, you know, before, when you are handling your assets, there are certain best practice that people don't know. You know, people just, the majority of people is going to buy the Bitcoin in Coinbase, leave them on Coinbase, never move them. And then, you know, maybe even show up, you know, their private key to their mom or you know, friends. I don't think people, that's why, you know, we come back to the beginning of the interview when I said, are people actually ready to self-custody their own assets? And it's the same things that comes down when we talk about private data. You know, with social media, just people give away all the data for free just to have access to something. I think we are still not at a stage where we really understand how important is privacy. It's not telling everybody your own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So at a societal level, people just don't think adversarially, and they aren't used to having to take on this level of responsibility and think about everything that can go wrong. But, you know, there are plenty of people in the space, especially those who have been around for a while, people who have a significant amount of their net worth in Bitcoin, who put in the time, the effort to educate themselves and to be able to navigate the space safely.
Listen, let me know the progress that you are making, and maybe we need more events gathering where, you know, we raise awareness about that and get those people to talk about and, you know, drive the discussion, because I think that's it's all about awareness, right? So,
well, I mean, you know, the major, the institutions, the nation states, like, there are people who are aware of this, they're tracking it. Kind of like you have relationships with people who are doing quantum VC, their institutions have investments in companies that are doing quantum. And so they're getting reports from the people who are making advancements on quantum. And then, of course, they're serving a lot of customers who could be negatively impacted by this. So, yeah, there is an awareness at a really high level, even if, like, maybe the average Bitcoin investor isn't clued in. I think that, you know, the stakes are high enough that, you know, the people who have a lot to lose are going to be paying attention.
Yeah, true. Jameson, thank you for coming on the show. It was a great chat.
Thanks for having me.